they didn't record your introduction. So welcome, thank you for coming. Let's see, let me just, so yes, I can now put a UW email account, which is really exciting, and I appreciate the opportunity to work with people, and so really this is kind of part of, you know, the start of hopefully a lot of collaboration. You see in my affiliation it says the NLP group. That means whenever I read out a sentence in one of my examples that is from the molecular biology field, that means I don't know anything about what those words mean. I just know that they hang together. Please don't ask me any questions about the proteins involved here. And just, this is joint work of it, with my colleagues. With my colleagues Chris Quirk, Paula V. Chowdhury, and Michael Gammon. So I'm going to talk to you about the BioNLP shared task, and really the background is that I overheard this really interesting conversation. This conversation, you know, it's kind of like, it's an on, you know, you get to the party, it's an interesting conversation, you have to figure out how to become part of the conversation so that then you get to ask the questions that you really want to. So this lecture is kind of about hearing that conversation, becoming part of it, and now asking questions. Who was talking were people who identify themselves as the special interest group from biomedical, for the biomed. I think that primarily those are NLP practitioners, but it's a group that specifically wants to bring together researchers from bioinformatics, computational biology, medical informatics, and NLP. But I don't know who started the conversation, but these are the people who are talking. I don't know how involved bioinformatics researchers were in the beginning. What they're talking about this new corpus that they have. It's the Genia corpus. What they've done was using the key terms from MeSH that are human blood cells and transcription factors, they've collected a corpus of 2,000 abstracts. What they did then with those abstracts, so they're kind of roughly on this in this area. What they've done with those abstracts is they've now annotated them. The annotators are people who are biologists, because what they said is we want for the information that we annotate to be relevant and important to biologists. So presumably, the annotations that we're going to work with are interesting to people in computational biology. There are some issues that brings about with respect to how the data was annotated. But in principle, it ought to be interesting to biologists. And what you may not know is that for the machine learning community and for the NLP community, if you give them a corpus, they will come. So if you give them an annotated corpus, they will land on that. And they will sit there and work on it and try to improve without really knowing how it's going to be applied. So better make sure that the annotation is what you want up front, because these people will be working on it for a long time. They did that with word sense disambiguation. There are all these corpora that people in machine learning and NLP work on. But let's make sure it's the right corpus. So that's kind of part of, that's the what and the why of the conversation. Well, yeah, the background, it's of course information overload, right? Because that's the all-consuming trite thing to say right now. But it is true in your field. There are so many publications, you can't possibly consume them all. And the only way that you have of accessing information today is through some form of search engine, whether it's a domain-specific search engine, such as is available on PubMed, which gives you a limited amount of kind of alternate, if you issue a query with key terms, it might include some alternatives, some synonyms, but maybe not all that you care about, and maybe not in ways that you have control over. And the thing is, the question is, are these keywords or key phrases, are they enough to satisfy your information need? Because once you issue them, now it's your job to make sense of the entire body of literature that's coming back to you, and it's extremely time-consuming and relies on your memory, which, we're all tired and, just reading too much. So I would be interested to know, in general, if search engines are, in fact, enough for you to do the information gathering, and if it's a good way for you to do the research, then maybe this whole conversation is not interesting, in fact. Maybe search engines have solved it all. Yes.
Can I ask you about search engines? Are you referring to their application to unstructured text or to structured text?
To unstructured text.
Unstructured text.
Right. So, do you, you know, like, can you just let Google, you know, index a whole bunch of documents, you issue query terms, is that enough? If it's enough, then, you know, that's fine. Then what the people in BioNLP are doing is not applicable. But hopefully it isn't enough, because there seems to be some need. So that's what I'll talk about today, is that the BioNLP shared task. I'll give you some examples, what it is that they've annotated, tell you a little bit about why it's challenging, why I personally am interested in this task. I'll tell you about one system that we implemented in order to perform the task. It's one of many, and it performs well enough. It's simply an example. And the point here is I don't mean for you to be able to have enough information that you can go out and build your own system. What I'd like you to take away is this is how people in NLP think about the problem. These are how we encode our intuitions about what might be good clues to do this task. And you may have lots to contribute in terms of your intuitions. So I'll give you the system results so that you know what the state of the art is. And then what I'd really like to start is asking questions about, okay, how do we take that data and do something with it? How do we make it do stuff for us? And I'll give you some examples that I've put together that use information visualization. I'll give some examples of where we might do a human and machine collaboration to get better data. And then the overall goal for the talk is simply to update non-NLP researchers, hopefully there's some non-NLP people in this audience, with the state of the art for information extraction, so that you can know what you can expect us to do and what you can't expect us to do, but I hope it's good to have an update on that. So let's talk about the BioNLP shared task. So what is it? So from this corpus that they've collected, the Genia corpus. This is one sentence. So it goes, in this study, we hypothesized that the phosphorylation of TRAF2 inhibits binding to the CD40 cytoplasmic domain. I hope that I'm saying these things properly. Forgive me. So what is it that the task organizers have done? They've said, okay, we know that there's two proteins in here. And I think that that's true. I don't see any other proteins. So they've given us two proteins. So what they, now they gave this text to the biologists and said, okay, give me some annotations for things that are about events that have proteins as their argument somewhere. What the biologists have said is that they, in this sentence, there's phosphorylation of TRAF2 going on. That's an event that involves these biomolecules. There's a binding of TRAF2 to CD40. If you think that this is not correct, I'd be really interested in.
It's not correct.
So that's interesting already. So that's part of the thing with the data, is that we're given this data, we don't know whether it's correct or not, but our systems are being evaluated on it. So if you don't think it's correct, that's interesting.
Yeah, TRAF2 is inhibiting the binding of something to CD40. It's not saying what it's inhibiting.
What it's that? Okay, thank you for that insight, because in fact, getting this to come out right, you have to do all kinds of contortions, which to me feels wrong. So that's interesting. But then there's an instance of negative regulation going on, and then it's the whole phosphorylation event that negative regulates the binding event. So that's what the biologists tell us would be useful to have extracted from this text. So now you give it to the NLP people and they say, ha, we've got data, let's build systems. So while this is maybe a reasonable way that humans would like to think about the problem, the computer needs to think about it slightly differently.
I'm sorry, I'm actually going to take back what I said. And now that I read it again, I think that could actually be a correct interpretation. So
okay, maybe in context it's correct? Maybe if you had the sentence before and after?
Well, actually, I think my biological knowledge would tell me if it's correct or not.
The phosphorylation inhibits the binding.
But it's
what?
The
binding of what to CD40?
It could be TRAF2, it could be something else, given context. I mean,
binding in general, or specifically?
The biology relevant. The CD40 is a cell surface protein in the immune cell. their cytoplasmic domain is the part that's in, inside the cell. Mm-hmm. That things are binding into to that domain. The question is a trap two, the phosphorylation of trap two that is unbinding or
right. Or binding of something else into that.
Oh, anyway, sorry.
So the computer needs to think about it in terms of pointers to words. So T1 is a pointer to the string trap two. And so what the task is that we have to look at all of these words and decide this word phosphorylation is a pointer to the class phosphorylation. And then this event phosphorylation, now that I know I have an event, I can have a theme. And that theme is a pointer, again, to this protein trap too. So this is what the computer needs to consume.
So can you go through those numbers a bit more? What's 57, 62?
These are random identifiers. So these are the offsets for this word. So the word phosphorylation spans text input positions 39 to 54.
And capitalization means it's a class versus lowercase means?
Yes, this is the class, this is the event class, and this is the word in the text that this is a key for.
So protein and theme and cause name.
Right. And again, you can see that it has the nestedness. It's the cause is the whole event, the phosphorylation. That's the part that interests me in particular. So if you go to the BioNLP shared task website, you'll see that it has different corpora. I'm going to talk about the genia corpus and the epigenetics corpus. They have different sets of events that are annotated for those corpora. There's also one on infectious diseases and other corpora as well. This means that it has annotated both hydroxylation events and dehydroxylation events, which is kind of, that tripped us up slightly. So those are the goals. So why is this challenging? Well, so negative regulation as an event type is expressed by a lot of different words in the English language. In fact, this number is, I have 157 instances of the word decreased when it indicates a negative regulation. And that you could handle because you can just build a gigantic dictionary of the words that express negative regulation, look them up, and be happy. The problem is that one single word can refer to multiple different event types. So the word detected sometimes indicates gene expression, sometimes it indicates positive regulation, and so on, each with its own probabilities. But you want to look at the context to see, okay, when does this word mean this, when does it mean that? And that is the real challenge. Similarly, the fact that you have these nested events, that's the part that really kind of made me be interested in this task. Because if you just have a relation between two proteins, that's challenging, but you may be able to solve that without reference to the underlying structure of the sentence. This requires kind of syntactic processing, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that. So this is one system. It's among many. But it follows a similar architecture, and I don't mean for you to be able to read all the details. But what you can see is it's a pipeline. We're going to do a whole bunch of tasks one after the other. We're first going to read in the data, right? And then we're going to find what the sentences are, we're going to find where the words are, we're going to mark the particular words as being proteins or not. Then we're going to do data preparation, and I'll tell you more about that. We're going to have as input not only the string sentence, but a set of abstract representations for that string sentence. All of these are going to together give us clues, and clues are really the feature extraction. Feature extraction is what can I extract from the sentence and the abstract representation that will give me clues about what these events are and who are the big actors in these events. The features really are at the lexical level, at the syntactic level, and at the semantic level, and I'll give you examples of those. Once we have kind of the data prepared and all of the features, now we do our tasks, our main tasks. We have trigger detection. I have to tell you which word could be a trigger for an event, and what are the arguments. Once I've done that, I have a small post-processing component, which kind of fixes up obvious errors. It's important to know that this is a model that uses machine learning algorithms. I don't take these features and write rules for them, because I could. And I did that for many years, in fact, in the 90s. You'd take kind of features and you'd say, if I see this, then it's probably that. The reason why we don't do that anymore is that they're very inflexible. You can't move from one domain to another. I can't go from genia corpus, where I have this set of relations that I'm supposed to extract, to this other corpus in epigenetics, where I have a completely different set. I don't want to have to rewrite all those rules. So I'm always looking for a general purpose framework where I can encode my intuitions about what are good clues for making these predictions, but in a very flexible way. So that's a very important kind of design decision that we make. And you know, at Microsoft, we like to think we're building stuff that are platforms. So this is a platform for information extraction. So I promise to tell you more about the data preparation. So first you have the sentence, and we break up the text into separate sentences, and for each sentence you have a set of words. Now you want to say, okay, give me another representation of that set of words. And that's what we do when we parse. Now you probably parsed in elementary school. You probably had to do sentence diagramming. This is the subject, this is the object, these things go together, those go together. That's really what we're doing here, what we call the constituency parse. You're taking, you know that this determiner, the, and the noun phosphorylation together make a noun phrase, and that you can have a preposition and a noun phrase together, those make a prepositional phrase. And I can have a prepositional phrase post-modify a noun phrase. So I build up a hierarchical representation of the sentence. And the point here is to tell you this is mature technology now. So there are both statistical parsers, which we are now using. These are the McCloskey-Charniak parser, the general one. You can improve those statistical parsers by letting it do some domain adaptation. Then you get something. This one was specifically trained on Genia. Or you can use any number of in-house parsers. What you may not know is that every single sentence you've ever written in Word has been parsed since 1996. We don't store them. They're on your desktop. But it is very mature technology. It's fast. It's reliable. It doesn't crash your machine. Mostly. Not in Word. The research ones sometimes take your machine down. For these parses, you can get it to tell you, give me the one best parse. But there's not always one best. You can say, okay, give me your 50 best parses. And I can do that for one parser, or I can do that for a number of parsers. So I can get the 50 best parses from three different parsers. And now I can also compute the probabilities over all of the edges. How likely is this edge to contribute to a good parse? So now I have probabilities. I've got lots and lots of parses. That's almost too much. So instead, what we find is that a better representation, which you can compute off, so this is computed from this, is a dependency parser. And I'll just a little bit skip here. Where what you really want to remember is that there is a determiner relation from phosphorylation to the. There's a subject relation from inhibit to phosphorylation. See, that's the kind of thing that tells you this is probably a pretty good clue. Because if I'm looking for causes of a negative regulation, I'm probably going to find them when they're subjects or when they're objects. So that's a good level of representation for giving me clues about these event types and so on. So once I've prepared the data, now I have to do the two main tasks. There's trigger detection, and then there is the edge detection. So what we do with trigger detection is we go through each word and you say, is this a trigger? No. Is this a trigger? Yes. Is this a trigger? No. Is this a trigger? No, because it's protein. Is this a trigger? Yes. And so on. So that's the task. Can you do that task? Go through each word. So what are the clues that you can use? Well, you can know something about each word. So when we go through, step through each word, we know something about the word. We know its stem. Maybe we think that common character engrams will give us some clue. Maybe Asian always means something. So we throw that into the pile of features that we think might give clues. Maybe that it has an uppercase, maybe. We just kind of keep generating clues. We're going to let the machine learning algorithm decide what the weight is and which ones to keep, which ones to throw away. But we're just going to generate whole bunches of clues. A really good clue is, have you seen this word as a trigger before? That's a really good clue. But it's not always the case, right? You can also keep track of what other words do you co-occur with. So for this word that I'm looking at, what other words do you co-occur with? Maybe that's a good clue. Maybe I always see a protein in the sentence. If I don't see another protein in the sentence, it's probably not a trigger, because I can have a phosphorylation event. But if I don't say what proteins it's interacting with, then that's not a good trigger in that sentence. Then coming back to where information that we can get from this, you know, complicated or the more abstract representation, we're going to look at what can we get out of the dependency. So if I'm looking at phosphorylation, maybe a clue is that three hops away, I have, or one hop away, I have a verb. Or maybe a clue is that I have a dependent. Maybe this is two hops away. So I'm going to construct for this word phosphorylation all combinations of all paths up to two away, with their words and without their words. So these are just ideas that we throw in the pot, and again, we're going to let the machine learner decide which one is right. But these are ideas, and this is one that I introduced recently, which is, for this word, what does my shortest path to a protein look like? That actually, that particular feature was very informative for this task, and we got 2 points out of that one, F measure, so that was a very important feature. I haven't seen that one yet. So there's still lots of room, you know, where if you look at the text, you're like, well, I think you could tell if I looked at these things. So we put that in, and then you give it to the machine learning algorithm and say, okay, did it give any weight to that feature? So there's still a lot of room for improvement in feature engineering here, and for knowledge to be put in the system. The other thing is we do some clustering. So for, this is the semantic layer, where you can look at PubMed, or you can look at the specific corpus, Genia, and you can cluster the words. Lots of different clustering algorithms. But what you're trying to do is say, okay, I want up to 1,000 clusters for this corpus. And then it's going to say, well, these words belong in the same pile, and this word belongs in a different pile. So then for each word, I know which cluster does it belong to. Maybe that's a way of kind of doing some generalization. So that's trigger features. Now, the edge detection is a similar task, but now I have two nodes and an edge. So for each possible, we've done the trigger detection, we know which words are triggers. Now, for each trigger to trigger or trigger to protein, I'm going to hypothesize an edge. I'm going to say, are you an edge? Are you an edge? Are you an edge? And I'm going to let the machine learning algorithm give me weights for all of those edges and class distribution. It's a multi-class classification problem. For each edge, I'm going to say, are you phosphorylation? Are you this? 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 And I have to also tell you what the argument type is for each edge.
I'm a little lost. So the triggers, do they match what a biologist would say is an important word in the abstract?
A word that indicates that a particular event type is going on. That's a trigger. So
it's connected to the notion of a verb?
No, it can be both a noun or a verb, right? Because phosphorylation is kind of the event of, but it can be, they have annotated prepositions as indicating triggers, as being triggers to indicate events. That's the part I don't agree with, right? Because you've asked biologists to shoehorn their intuitions into an annotation framework that doesn't match what they want to say. So there are some issues.
How are the biologists annotating? Are they annotating it based on like temporal events, or are they just annotating in terms of what this abstract is about?
What this abstract is about.
So how is it connected to events?
because...
It could be about the noun. It could be this abstract is about this gene. No event whatsoever.
Then it wouldn't be annotated, because they're only annotating events.
Oh, so they are jobs.
So those that list that I gave you a few slides back, Virginia, it's phosphorylation, catabolism.
Okay, so it has to be some process.
One of those nine.
So it is a process.
Right, it's a process. Okay. It's one of those nine, whatever.
Okay, so they're told to look for a process in which words are important.
Yes,
and then
thank you.
Edge? Sorry.
It's the process.
You find edges in terms of triggers, and that's why I asked about triggers. So
okay, so it's the process and the argument to the process, what the process is acting on.
Okay, and that's an edge?
That would be an edge for that.
For whom?
For the biologists, for this task. So the edge is from phosphorylation to TRAF2. That's an edge. They're saying there's a phosphorylation event with the object of TRAF2. It's acting
Are they asked to identify the roles for each process?
Yes. Well, let's make sure that we got the vocabulary right. They only get to say whether it's the object, the thing that's acted on, or it's the cause, the thing that's acting. Those are the only two roles that they get to say. They also have localization, so where it's taking place. That is there, but we haven't worked on that.
Yeah.
So it's there in the text. So then besides, to make those decisions, in addition to the regular features that we talked about for trigger detection, we also keep track of whether that edge that you're looking at, is it part of the path to a nearest protein? Or what trigger type is the second node? So if my trigger is phosphorylation, and I'm looking at an edge where the other node is binding, is very, very unlikely, according to this data, because you can only phosphorylate proteins in this data. So if I have a phosphorylation to a protein, I'm like, yay, high probability. So you can, these are intuitions where this is capturing the intuition that the kind of edge that you're looking at probably has an impact on whether the kind of node you're looking at probably has an impact on whether there's an edge or not. So that's how we encode our intuitions. So then once we have this bag of clues, this bag of features, now at training time, you're given this sentence in conjunction with previously published data on CRAF-induced phosphorylation of GABT factors. And they give you the information that this is a trigger. So then what do? You compute the bag of clues that you have for phosphorylation, which is, that's a snapshot, that's a fragment of the set of clues that we've generated. Talking what we just had, you know, you can do this based on the word, syntax. And now you're giving this to the machine learning algorithm, in this case it's an SVM, to say, look at all your training data, now put weights on all of these clues. Put weights on all of these clues. And so one clue is that this word phosphorylation occurs in the same sentence as the word previously. It's probably not going to be very interesting for deciding whether this is an event type or not. But the fact that it appears in the gazetteer, in the dictionary of words that can indicate phosphorylation, that's probably a really important clue. So again, I don't have to do this as a person. I don't have to write these rules. The machine learning algorithm will assign weights to all of these features. Then at test time, so imagine that I now have a test sentence, happens to be the same one, but we have a different sentence in test than we have in training. And I have this word phosphorylation. I'm trying to decide whether it's a clue for phosphorylation. So these are the highly informative features for the class phosphorylation. And indeed, I'm going to decide that this word is a trigger for the phosphorylation event with 0.6 probability. So that's pretty high. It could mean that there's no event going on, none, with 0.15. Or with very, very small probabilities, some of these other. That's just basically noise. So it's done what we wanted it to do, right? It seems trivial because you've got the word in phosphorylation in and you're trying to predict it. But under the hood, it's not trivial. And it applies generally, and I'm trying to pick an example so that it is clear to you what's going on. Now, I'm curious. Do you agree that this is a phosphorylation event with a protein? Well, you'd be wrong, just like our system is wrong, because not because we're wrong, but because the data is wrong. So I think the protein involved would probably be this GABP. See, that's the problem. It's the GABP factors. So there's not a single protein that they can point their finger to, so they didn't annotate it. So what that does, it messes up the training, because this is a training example. So I have a perfectly good example of phosphorylation event, but it doesn't have a single protein as its argument. So now this is going to look like there's no phosphorylation going on.
So again, what was the task given to the experts? I'm confused as to why they wouldn't validate
it. I think the task was not clear enough. So it's an interesting play, and I hope you don't mind that I'm trying to make this meta point, that data is very interesting because it becomes an object of research in and of itself. But how you construct the data really, really matters. It matters to how successful you can be, and it matters to whether you can use the output at the end of it. Is it interesting to do or not? And I guess that's kind of why I would like to talk about this here, because is this interesting? Yes.
So the annotators weren't aware of the relations you were trying to extract in a specific task, or they had no idea of the implied nature of the annotation?
They had no idea. Well, I mean, supposedly these were molecular biologists who did the annotation. So they had probably some idea of their own of what they were interested in doing, whether it matched what the organizers hoped they would. But it really is. And so for this reason, I think I'm going to go back right now to the task organizers, because I'm going to show you what our system results are. But I think you can't possibly get 100 because of the messed up nature of some of these data points. So I think there's a fairly low upper bound to what we can do automatically.
I don't know if you want to take this digression, but I mean, annotation, I'm very interested in annotation, and it's a very subjective task, and the goal, I assume your goal, and the goal of NLP in my mind, I'm not an NLP researcher, should be to do better than humans.
It doesn't need to be better than humans. There's no need to be better. I mean, I would say I don't think that there's any reason to believe that the machine could do better. It would be more tireless. It could do more articles. It's just simply tireless. But it's not going to be better. It may be more consistent. But consistent to the data it was given.
But why?
So we can talk about that a little bit later on. So then you get to the system results. So hopefully I've shown you how we do it. And there the goal was to say we encode our intuitions in terms of these features, and we let the machine learning algorithm do its thing. You can see here from the results roughly what the current state of the art is. The highest performing system, the highest performing single system had an F measure of 55.2. So that's a combined mean of a harmonic mean of recall and precision. So recall is of the things in the test data that were annotated, how many did I get? And precision is of the things that I hypothesized, how many were right? And F measure is a way of kind of giving a combined figure for those two. So the highest performing single system was 55.2 from University of Massachusetts. University of Massachusetts and Stanford University got together and did what they call a system combination. So they allowed, they trained both systems separately, then they trained a meta system on top of that to say, we don't know the details of this yet because it comes out in June, but to say, okay, who is more likely to be right and wrong? That system got a little bit better, 56. So that's the highest score today. We're at 51.5, so we came in third of about 11 systems. It's credible. You can see the difference. So if you look only at the test results for the single, simple events, so like gene expression will always only take a protein as its argument, and similarly transcription and protein catabolism. So there our accuracy is much higher, 71 on F measure. And in fact, you can get, so for precision, I think our highest precision is on protein catabolism. So of the 100 cases of, you know, annotated examples of protein catabolism, we nailed 87 of them. And we have pretty high recall in phosphorylation, for example. So it kind of, you know, these numbers, sometimes they're the same, sometimes they're out of whack. So our recall is quite low on localization, though it is quite high in its precision. So, you know, we're still looking at those. That's the simple events. For binding, which is interesting because it requires you to identify one or more arguments, but they're still proteins, we get a little bit, that's kind of 64%. The real Achilles heel is the most challenging, and that's why it's an interesting task. We only get 40%, or 40F measure, for the regulation events, where the regulation events always have like a complex, a nested event. So you've got to get the whole thing right to get credit for it. So it's really tricky, because if you get one piece, you might get the whole cause right, but if you mess up on the theme, then you don't get any credit for the thing. So it's really quite challenging. But, you know, at least it's, like, you know, way better than chance. I mean, you can't even compute chance on this. It's, you know, you wouldn't be able to. And, you know, it's reasonable. And we don't know what the upper bound is. For epigenetics, the point of doing the epigenetics was to prove to ourselves that our system design was sufficiently general to move from one area, from one domain to the next. So, and you know, kind of, again, we're third of these systems, so we're happy that it's a general system. Again, that's very important to us. So, hopefully, I could tell you why this is an interesting task. We might quibble with how the annotation was done, whether it's the right thing. So I've kind of sidled into the conversation. We've contributed our system. I think we now have a place at the table. So we can start to talk to the task organizers and say, can we rephrase this task? Maybe we take care of some of the annotation problems. But mostly now the question that I want to ask is, how are we going to use this? The hypothesis was, you know, so the bioinformatics guys tell us, hey, this would be cool, we need this. The biologists tell us, we need this level of annotation. NLP people say, okay, we can do that. And now I want to say, now what? What do we do with it? Because I'm not satisfied to just keep working on this task years after year after year, getting better, 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 if it's not going to be used. So let's just say, so how can we translate these results? So you get an input text. B cells were found to express BMP type 1 and type 2 receptors, and BMP6 rapidly induced phosphorylation of this. Okay. So then you're like, okay, this is what the system outputs right now. And I'm guessing that nobody wants to look at that, because you have to follow the pointers and it makes no sense. So this is what is useful for a computer. Instead, we have a system that takes the raw output and makes them friendly, right? So I have a positive regulation going on. BMP6 is doing the regulating, and it regulates phosphorylation of SMAD1. Okay, so that's what we have. We call them friendly facts. So if you had friendly facts, then you could have a better search engine, because now I can search for regulation or for binding. If I knew what classes I wouldn't want to know about, which is a big if, right, because right now we only have 9. But who's to say that I don't want to look at something completely different? And then I wouldn't have that support. But let's assume we can anticipate all categories. Now you could have a better search engine. It would solve your memory recall problem. You don't have to remember anymore what paper mentioned that such and such was regulated. And If you do that, you have a knowledge base that's very entity-focused, and to get access to find something, you have to know what you're looking for. So that's one thing I'll say about that type of knowledge representation. And what you have, when you put all those friendly facts together, is you've got Watson, I think, right? Because Watson is, that's exactly, now you can ask it lots of questions. It has infinite memory recall. If it's seen a paper, it will, you know, tell you about it. The question is that enough for, you know, kind of to really make a difference to the way bioinformatics, computational biologists do their research? Is that the kind of information that you would need?
So I was just wondering, in the journey of purpose, it would seem to me, and I don't know anything about this particular field and domain, but it would seem to me that over time, research would lend some hypothesis incorrect over time. And you know, if you're just looking at the grammatical or the linguistic features of and not deeper into the semantics, make it a situation where you have totally correct sentences
yes. And
expressions and relations between entities. Mm-hmm. However, they contradict each other over time
right. Because
science has now proven that one is no longer actually true.
That's entirely possible. Hold that thought until like 2-3 more minutes. Then I have one visualization which might go in that direction. So it's been suggested that using graphs in computational biology is very useful. And it's interesting. I do not see any follow-on work to this. It's by Natarajan, and it was published in 2006. I don't see any follow-on work. Maybe you do know of any follow-on work. But what they did was they were running these gene expression experiments, and they had 72 genes that were differentially expressed, and they wanted to know why. And so what they did was they went to the text, they did the full text mining, they built the gene interaction networks, and they said, that looks interesting. And they, in fact, found what they were looking for by encoding the information in a graph and then looking at the graph. Note that they didn't already know what they were looking for. It was kind of this graph research, I mean, kind of graph exploration. So if we translate the results for our sentence into a graph, you get something that looks like this. But one sentence at a time isn't going to tell you anything. That's not the right graph representation. So I've been playing with an imperfect tool, NodeXL, which is kind of interesting. You may not know about it already. It's an Excel template that's available at this site. The main collaborators are now outside of Microsoft. But you give it two columns. This is for binding. So column one, column two. These proteins bind to this protein. That's all you need to know. And then it removes duplicate edges and keeps track of how many times you've seen a binding event between FOXP3 and P300. Right? And so it counts those. Now I can turn that into a graph. It's hairy. But that represents the binding information that is present in the genea corpus. The question is, if you could interact with it, which I don't have right now, I just took a screenshot, if you could interact with it, if you could zoom in and zoom out, would it tell you something interesting? I zoomed in on this one spot, and like I say, it's imperfect. It's a research prototype. But if this is a direction that's interesting to you, I'm very interested in developing and improving these visualization tools. Because if you look at P50, I can quite quickly see all of the proteins that it binds to. And I believe that it would have taken me a long time to find that from text. So this is it's a semantic representation of the underlying text that allows you to search in a way that's not text-based. And I think it also supports kind of serendipitous findings. So like, if I'm looking at this, it's P50B, well, this guy also binds to P50 and P50B. Maybe that guy is of interest to me. And so you can traverse and find it in out information about things that you didn't necessarily know about, you think you needed to know about. So the Watson kind of metaphor here is less powerful because you have to know what you're looking for. Here you might find what you're looking for without knowing it beforehand. Just a curiosity about NodeXL, once I do that, I can then build little pictures for each of these proteins. by going out two edges or an arbitrary number of edges. Now I can see, oh, P50 must be a very different type of protein than this TRAF6, because it doesn't do very much in this text. But that thing is very active in this text. I'll just very quickly go through the fact that I can do this for regulation as well. It's a lot hairier, a lot more interesting information. In particular, because if I focus, I have the nodes in this graph are not only proteins, but also events, because it's the gene expression of beta 1 that regulates this guy, I don't know, RAV or something like that. So you can see that the complexity of this graph is much higher. But you might be able to say, okay, well, it's interesting that this gene expression of beta 1, it regulates stuff, but it regulates only proteins. Maybe there are other proteins that are more centered on regulating events. And I think you'd be able to see that from the pictures. Whether that's of interest to you, whether it would help trigger some ideas about how these interact, what I might use to interact. And so you can build these same pictures. See, this gene expression of FOXP3 is like really, really active. Can you see the red dot? So the red dot is here. So this one is interesting because binding of CD10 also binds to itself. That's a little self loop. So, and not all genes do that. So then very briefly, another way to do this is for active text, which is kind of an ongoing collaboration with Carol Ferris here at UW in the bioinformatics lab, where the idea is you can partner with the system, the human can partner with the system, because human manual curation is really the way that knowledge has been encoded in biology up till now. But you can see that if I have a sentence and I click on that sentence, I could extract kind of my bioevent level information, right? But now it's not just there the way it is in the bio-NLP share task. I'm going to allow a human to interact with it because maybe the fact says Leishmania are exposed to, maybe it's not just oxygen, it's probably reactive oxygen or it's reactive oxygen species. But I'm going to allow the user to put in what is the right thing, because we know we're only 50% correct. And, or you can write your own. Now these are interesting to me. Would a biologist write their own, right? And then, once we do that at scale, if the biology community writes their own, kind of using this tool, which is a computer assist to help teach you how to do it, then we have data that's real. And now we can train the systems and turn it around and give it back to the biology in graphs.
Question?
Yeah.
Is that text they're reading or is it text they're writing?
Can be either. Can be either. And then here we have a little bit more information because in this graph, I can see what are the facts that have been extracted, what are the concepts, but I can also see which articles did they come from. Who annotated those? So like if I really think that, you know, a particular researcher has a very good overview of something and they've actually spent a lot of time annotating, I can just say, okay, I want to see all annotations done by Maliha. And I would see the entire graph of knowledge that she has authored by reading or by writing documents. And so then you can tie it to time and you can see, okay, what do I get at a factual level? What do I get by looking at these other articles? So it's more like walking through the stacks, the way libraries used to be. You know, you'd kind of go, you'd like, okay, I want this book. Oh, this one looks really interesting. And that will, it's that effect. So I think, again, it supports information exploration. So, yeah, so the thing is that hopefully this can be a continuing conversation. So we've shown you that we can do these things. Pretty reasonable accuracy, they're not perfect. But now what's the next step? How can we take this further? Is this something that you could take and then, you know, process text and make interesting observations? Or is what these bio-NLP people doing just simply out in left field and not of any interest to you? would like to know that. I think we all would like to know that. So, so that's it. And I apologize for going over time. So. I don't know if there's time for questions further. Does it strike you that the output of the BioNLP shared task has any bearing on your work? That is the big question. Yes?
So I'd just like to ask you, this is mostly focused on the research domains. To what extent have you thought of it in terms of the healthcare domain with practitioner cognitive processes, and they'll have a different information domain in the back of their head?
Malia, when are you giving your talk?
I'm going to give. I think we have a joint project with Lucy, I, and Faisha from the linguistics department, and we are trying to extract pneumonia information from ICU reports. So we are applying NLP techniques to be able to model those kind of critical illness phenotypes. And I'm going to give a talk in 2 weeks. So,
right here.
Yeah.
And so the thing that makes these projects similar is that, again, we're trying to encode intuitions that we have about what are clues to pneumonia. And then, again, we don't write these as rules. We give them as whole sets of clues, and then we say, okay, given them some training data, what does the machine learning algorithm make of that? What things are... And in fact, we found with the professors... that we were talking about different getting weights on different features. So we showed them the set of features that received very high weight. And they thought that just seeing that feature list was interesting. It told them something about pneumonia. It felt right to them. So, and in fact, it suggested a few more things that they should, that maybe they hadn't intuited beforehand. But in fact, it kind of comes out of the data. And I think that, you know, over the last 10, 15 years, the revolution ongoing in NLP and other fields with machine learning has really told us there's a place for encoding your intuitions and your knowledge, but there's a real value to having the machine learning algorithms give weights to those and actually give probabilities to those features and intuitions in a way that you couldn't do manually.
One problem with especially this kind of data is that biologists aren't just using protein X. They're modifying it. They're looking at it from 15 different organisms or 100 different organisms. They're expressing the gene differently. They're making modifications. They're looking to see if this process is inhibited, if I change some other part of the physiology, is it recovering? Do you get these very, like you said, nested processes, so you're preventing the inhibition of the knockout of the fake organism that we made from scratch. It seems like it's a challenge over regular text when you've just got, maybe 100 different versions of a single protein, and every year there's going to be an additional modification, a way of annotating that in the text, and denoting that it's a modified version of protein. How do you deal with those kind of challenges?
So right now we don't have to deal with them, but I think that there would be ways of basically, if you knew that, if you could write down what are the synonyms of this, what are the very closely related, proteins to this one, and then treat that as a bag, maybe, or you get them all separate. It's an interesting question. How would we do that, and what would make sense?
So I can say from experience using after you've extracted it, even if you know the synonyms, be able to help the user draw conclusions based on this data that you've extracted is hard, because if one experiment is on one modified version of the protein and another is on another modified organism or a modified physiology or a different cell type, they may in fact be relevant to the canonical pathway or something.
Right.
But it's just sort of a challenge to put all that.
So how do you try to communicate to the user? What do you show them?
So, you know, I was involved with the company, and we were trying to do exactly what you've done, and we made an early decision. We're going to have humans annotate. We decided we can't get NLP to do this, at least at,
right.
You know, 15 years ago. But that was a multi-million dollar investment and decision that, you know, we have to have people do it.
Are they happy with that decision now, do you think?
I think it's a part of the solution, but NLP has its place as well. So
right. Right, that's why I was thinking about active text as kind of maybe the system can propose things and then it's easier for people to correct it.
I really think that's really the future, is not having unstructured text so much anymore.
And we've seen that with I worked on machine translation there too, and if you propose even a bad machine translation to a human editor who has to, you know, say I'm tasked with translating Word documents into French, even if you give me bad French to start with, I'm faster at my job than otherwise. And so we have actually made that, you know, that's an interesting finding. That's what a lot of people do now.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.